This podcast was recorded on the lands of the Boonwurrung people of the Kulin Nation, the land on which we're lucky enough to raise our sons and daughters. Always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Hey, before we get into today's episode, just a quick reminder that if you have someone that is currently pregnant and thinking about all the things that are ahead of them, from postpartum planning to breastfeeding and returning to paid work, to how on earth to navigate the childcare system and what they need to do now, we have just the guides for them. You can shop our Ready or Not go-to guides, Postpartum and Return to Work Planning, Breastfeeding and Returning to Work, and Childcare 101 for $69 as a bundle or $29 individually. They're packed full of information created with experts, and I personally think they're brilliant. You can shop them now in our show notes or readyornot.au. And I know times are tough, so here's a discount. Use Ready10 to get 10% off at the checkout. Hello and welcome to Witching Hour, the show that looks at what's exciting, delighting, intriguing and frustrating us when it comes to making work, work. I'm Lou and I feel like we've been separated for far more than just over a week. Who are you?
I know. Has it only been a week? Obviously. I mean, not obviously if you haven't listened before, but that's who I am.
You're world famous.
When did I last see you?
Oh, it's been 5,000 years.
Wow. Yeah. All right. I'll kick things off with a good news story, and you'll have to ignore my speech today because I got a filling and legitimately half of my face is numb, like I'm dribbling as I talk.
Quite literally, as on Zoom, I can tell. I'm quite impressed that you're here doing this, actually.
So here's my good news story. I signed up for this challenge at like a gym. I wouldn't even call it a gym because it doesn't have a gym. It has like Pilates and Reformer.
A wellness center.
And like yoga mats. Yeah.
And yoga mats.
Yeah. No,
it doesn't have yoga, just mats.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, and the stuff that comes with that. So I signed up for a 21-day challenge. And as part of that challenge, you have to do meditation to like win a prize. And you know what I'm like when it comes to winning or like a competition, I need to.
Yeah, it's less for your mental health and more for your ego.
And so I thought to myself, maybe this is good because I've tried meditation before and it wasn't for me. But life has been really busy recently, as you know, and I thought, you know what, maybe it's a sign that I need to give it another crack. So on Father's Day, the day all about the dads, I decided to book into a meditation class for me because let's be real, like, you know, mums do half the work, if not more, you know.
Yeah, I love that. Just on that, one of my friends went to a class on Sunday morning and I was like, that is a slay to do that on Father's Day. Go, girl.
So last night, on Sunday night, I went to a meditation class and I voice messaged Lou straight after because of this. I was lying down with a blanket on, my eye mask on, already feeling slightly uneasy. This lovely woman led the meditation with, you know, talking about, I don't know, what did they talk about, Lou? Like, close your eyes, imagine this, deep breath.
Yeah,
like
was that. It yoga nidra? So I don't know if we've ever spoken about this, but a fun fact is that I'm a yoga teacher, which is why Loz is asking me what it is. But was it like, were you imagining being in a forest and things like that or not necessarily?
No, it was more
like body parts.
Yes, it was the body part thing. Like
moving through different body parts.
Yes. Yeah. So I was trying to get involved and for the first 5 minutes, I'm like, okay, I can do this. It's not too bad. Then the lady next to me started and I'm not even kidding her. I almost want to make the noise snoring, but it wasn't like a, it was like a, noise. And I thought to myself, is it a chick for real? So I kind of like moved a bit and the person behind her, like I could tell was shuffling as if to be like, what are you doing, woman? Like we get that it's like a meditation, but it's not a snooze fest.
No, but to be fair, if she was that tired to fall asleep, it's sort of more on the teacher, do you think?
Okay, so this is what I wanted to pose. So my good news story is I went to a meditation class, which for me is a big thing. My bad news story is I couldn't actually meditate or switch off or think of anything other than this woman next to me breathing so effing loudly that it ruined my entire experience.
And don't you reckon you get angrier now because you have less time and because maternal anger is a genuine thing? Like I would get more angry now than had that happened pre-kids.
So my rage actually shifted throughout the class, like two different areas of my body. and to different people within the class.
Now focus your bad feelings on your knees.
I was like, oh my God. I thought to myself, okay, this is irritating. Hopefully it ends. And then other people started to shuffle and I'm like, right, I'm not the only person hearing this. This is beginning to get like ridiculous. Then I thought to myself, as a teacher, would you not move around the room and say something like, for those of you who are deep in your trance, whatever the flip it's called, bring awakening or bring, what's that, you know, bring
awareness and a lack of snoring back to the room.
Awareness back to your breath or something. It didn't happen. And another thing on that, I had a gentleman behind me. I could smell his feet. It was not okay. So not only did I have to deal with that and try to block out that heinous smell, I also had someone next to me. And when the class finished, I like sat up and I locked eyes with the other lady next to the snorer. And it's like we both gave each other acknowledgement, like, what a waste of time.
Did you nearly laugh or was it not even laughable at that stage?
No, I was in rage, anger.
Oh,
I had
fuck,
actually
I feel that in my chest.
I spent 40 minutes meditating on my rage. It was so bad. So
didn't you also say that the man was breathing really loudly?
He originally was breathing really loudly. But then to be real, I was so fixated on the person next to me. I don't know if he's breathing like leveled out or if I just couldn't focus on anything other than her.
Oh, I feel rage for you.
I do want to pose a question. What is acceptable breathing practice in meditation in terms of noise levels? Should it be silent?
I think that, so obviously there's moments where we ask you to be audible. Like as you might remember at the start of class, I would tell you to breathe in through your nose and big exhale out of your mouth. And that's like everyone just letting go, getting in the mode. Then if you're breathing in a way that's very yogic to genuinely practice that type of breathing, it might be slightly audible, but anything above that for me is performative and rude.
When you can hear a snort.
Yeah, that's not okay. Mum and I have always lamented that men breathe much louder in yoga. I don't know if it's a naivety thing or if it's just a chauvinist thing. It's probably both.
Yeah, it's a show-off thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It is.
And it's so enraging. And then when it comes to that person falling asleep, they obviously can't help that they fell asleep. It's up to the teacher to give them a gentle pat and say, you're falling asleep. You're actually making a bit of noise. Well, it's hard for me to know if it was actually sleep because I wasn't there. I would love to know if that person was breathing in a way, but they weren't asleep, but basically snoring, then they need to have a good hard look at themselves and not go to a class.
I was almost like so angered because I'd sat there in the room just taking in this noise. I was almost so angered that at the end I wanted to say, you should get that checked out.
Yeah, well, do you know what? There was someone that had this cough and they kept coming to my class and they said, I don't have COVID or anything. I just cannot shake this cough. I've had it about a year. And every time I lie on my back, the cough comes up. And it's a really tricky one because say this person had some sort of apnea or breathing problem. It's tricky because I don't want them to not be able to come to a class. But if it's going to ruin someone else's experience, I'm not sure. I don't know. You might have to do online classes. But then what does that say about like more broadly ableism and inclusivity? I don't know. You know what I mean? Like in different contexts?
I do know what you mean.
I don't know.
But I don't even want to go down that path because I'm still enraged.
To anger.
Like, what the flip? I get that you're relaxed, mate, but the other 22 people in the room are not.
That's really
hard. Take one for
the
team.
That is a really hard position to be in. And for the teacher, I think I would have given a bit of a tap and maybe said, hey, are you struggling to breathe on your back or are you falling asleep or what is it? And gone from there. Because if I know one thing, a mum getting to a class on her own to try and relax, to then not be able to relax, sounds like the most infuriating thing on
the planet. It was torturous. Anyway, we spent too long on this. Let's get into it.
Yeah, well, hopefully this has been a bit of a therapy session for you. Loz, today on the show, we're basically career and motherhood agony aunts. We've had four people separately within a week write in with their conundrums. And so we thought, why not make a whole episode about it? So today, four totally different problems that mums are having within their career that we're going to discuss on the show. Let's take it away. I'm going to play the questioner as per usual. I'm going to make you the sort of more key advice giver and I will jump in with mine as we move through as well. So here is the first one. This one's via voice memo from a very, very loyal listener who we love. So just telling you before we get going that we love you.
Hey, lovely. Thank you so much for offering to help me with this. So I've only recently gone back to work after having my son a year and a half ago. I'm a primary school teacher, and prior to having my son, I loved my job. Since returning, I've noticed that I feel that I just don't love it anymore. I feel like it sucks the little amount of energy I have left out of me, and I can't help but think about how I could be paid the same amount of money, if not more, doing something that asks far less from me. At this stage of my life where I'm going to be a mum to young children, I feel that any paid work I take on, I want it to be less physically and emotionally demanding than the work it takes to be a primary school teacher. So essentially, I just want to press pause on my teaching career as I know I can go back to it in the future if I'd like to. But my problem is I just don't know where to start when it comes to looking for a job in another field of work. I understand my previous experience is limited to teaching, so I'm probably looking for an admin role somewhere, but I'd love to work somewhere progressive with a great culture. I just don't know how to go about it. So any advice would be so appreciated.
Such a common one, I would say. I feel like so many mums go through this. Lozzie, give us your hot tips. I actually have what I think to be a pretty good tip that I'm going to add. I want to hear from you first, though.
Go first.
Okay. Do you really want me to go first?
Yes.
All right. So in my head, I've got a square and I've divided it up into four. I have my motherhood square. I have my values square. I have my passions square. And I have my expertise square. So in my motherhood square, I'm going to fill out the things that I need from a career when it comes to the logistics and also the emotions. So it might be for you that you don't want to work more than 3 days a week. You want 2 days a week with your child. That would go in there. It would be the mixture of how much I need to work from home versus where daycare is, versus where I physically can go into an office space, how much I can go into an office space. All that stuff around how motherhood affects what sort of job you want, I'm putting in the motherhood section. In the value section, I'm going to put in all the things to do with how she was talking about that she wants to work at a progressive company. Does that have to do with more environmental stuff for you? Does that have to do with equity and equality for women? Does it have to do with working with transgender children or females? Or what are the values that you really, really would love to bring into a work situation if you can? Next up in interests, I'm thinking about the things that you actually like. Do you like fashion? Do you like sports? Do you like politics? What are the things that light you up? Write a list of all of those things. And then in our last column, which is your expertise, put in everything that you have achieved in your corporate career and list them in here. So what are all of your skills and how can they be transferable? As soon as I'm thinking of this person working in education, I'm thinking that they could work at somewhere like the Big Sister Experience, which is who I interviewed last week on the show. They go in and run education workshops with young people. If that's still too sort of draining and physically taxing, how could you apply your education background into another field? For example, I've worked in sporting codes before. There's always participation programs. They work a lot with schools. That could be another avenue for which you could bring your values, what you need as a mum, and what your interests are. Say you are interested in sport, and bring that into a career. So I'd fill out this table with these four different squares and then start to identify the sort of jobs you're looking for.
I love that.
Thank you. What would you add?
I'm more black and white. I think what happens a lot of the time with women in particular is that they feel like their skills are only linear to a specific industry. And they're not. So I would assume the person that left a voice memo really feels like they're stuck with teaching, which is a bigger problem. Firstly, you're not. Secondly, look at the skills that you've gained and look at, if you don't want to swap industries, if you feel like it's going to be too hard to jump on, look at industries that are similar. So examples may look like universities who have great flexible work arrangements. They often provide like 17% superannuation.
Bit more progressive as a general rule, I'd say probably. Bit more future focused.
Yep. I think traditionally universities have been looked at in a bit of a boring light. But with the likes of a lot of online universities like RMIT Online, they're becoming far more progressive and their cultures are way more exciting. So that could be an avenue for you. Look at larger organizations like the Department of Education. Like, you are a prime candidate to work for somebody like that. You would slot straight in and be like, I could advise on all of these things because I've worked in it. So that's a great one. If you do not want to do teaching, HR, look at all of the skills that you've learned within teaching straight away, applicable to HR. Maybe not from a policy perspective, but from an everything else perspective. And the other thing that I would say is if you're looking for a culture in a progressive company, education tech companies are booming. So there's companies that are Melbourne-based. And I had a quick look on Seek before. There was like 49 jobs that were at a mid-range level, so offering between $100,000 and $150,000, which I would assume if you've been in teaching for a long time, you might be between that 80 to 130 level. So it's right within your bracket. And companies like that are super progressive. There's like so many different options once you're in to move around and expand your skills and to move into a different area. Just because you're in teaching, it doesn't mean that you can't move to marketing, product-based roles, HR, consulting. You just got to get your foot in the door. So have a look online. One of the companies that's, I think, Australian-based is called Toddle, and it's excellent.
Wow, I think we've just come at that at great angles, if I do say so myself. Learned a lot just there, Lozzie. Next one is a little bit more finance-focused. And when I say a little bit, I mean totally finance-focused. So here we are. My question is about financial recognition for caring work. I know everyone does finance stuff differently, so there's no single answer, but interested in your thoughts. My partner and I both split our salary evenly into three accounts, one for our home loan / renovation savings, one is a joint account for groceries and all of that, and then the remaining third goes into our individual accounts, which we both like as I don't want to fund his video game purchases or justify spending $100 on a face cream. Last time I was on mat leave, we maintained this approach, but I'm realizing it's yet another area I'm making a sacrifice as the primary carer, given there's less going in to my personal account for 6 months. So this person is on their second round of parental leave.
Yeah.
And beyond if I go back to work fewer days than my partner. I'm currently getting government paid parental leave and then using annual leave at half pay. So is it fair to pay myself a salary and then split the remainder across home loan / joint account? Or do we need to rethink how we manage our finances during this time so all our income goes in together?
It's such a tricky one. Finances can be really polarizing in different relationships. For me, personally, I think when you take mat leave, mostly you won't get paid superannuation. So you're already down in respect to what your partner gets. Most people return back to work, not on a full-time capacity for one reason or another. Maybe it's to have more time with your children. Maybe it's to cut costs on childcare. Whatever the reason may be, it means that your earning potential is reduced. It also means that your superannuation, again, is reduced. I would also say that when you're on maternity leave, and this might not be for everyone, but it certainly happened to me, if you're the primary carer, you tend to spend money without even realizing it on everyday stuff for your children. That's not factored in anywhere. And it's probably going to come out of your personal account, which means it should be me funds.
Yeah.
Your me funds are going to be depleting, 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 depleting. And most likely they're not going to be spent on you. So this is a great question. I would, and I do, look at it from a joint perspective. Join your funds if you can, split them out into whatever goals, saving wise, and expenses that you have. And that money is collectively like a family fund. That's the way that I would look at it. Would you do the same? I just think to myself more so, your government leave, like people are like, oh, but I'm getting government pay. Yeah, mate, at minimum wage, you are probably earning more than that. So like everything is not working in your favor. Whereas your partner is earning a full-time wage. So their me fund is just increasing, increasing, increasing. Your me fund is not only decreasing because of factors outside of your control, but you're most likely the primary caregiver of your child. And without even knowing it, every day you're spending money out of your account on things that benefit your family, whether it be taking your kids out to a play center, whether it be grabbing them a lolly because they're having a tantrum, whether it be getting a baby chino for that. It's all of those things add up, whether it's a quick duck to the supermarket, oh, I'll just quickly grab a pack of this or a yogurt. Like, I know it's $2, but the reality is...
No, but it adds up.
Yeah, it adds up.
Yeah, what I'm trying to figure out live as we record this that I can't quite do the math on is this person. So if they get them divided into thirds, say you wanted to keep doing the thirds thing, then realistically, the person on parental leave's personal fund should be greater than the other ones for that time is another way of approaching that, right? So you either share the funds and likely the parental or the primary caregiver is spending more of it because they have the kids and they're doing the activities or, you know, replenishing whatever that child needs. So it's either you come together with a pool of funding, knowing that person, that primary caregiver is probably spending more of it on the kids that they're looking after, or you look at, you pool that money, you put it into an individual account, and then really the primary caregiver should get a little bit more, even though they're earning a little bit less. Is that the other option there?
I think it's around the conversation that you have with your partner.
Yeah.
So I think what happens so often is women don't have the conversation and they probably don't even realize that they don't have the wage that they used to have or that they're spending more than what they assume. Or they're just saying, oh, but I'm still getting government pay. Yes, my friend, you are, but it is minimum wage. And the likelihood is your work previously was not at a minimum wage.
But what's confusing me about this is if they're pooling that money, even though it's government pay, and then putting it across three different accounts, aren't they both ending up with the same amount in their personal account?
No, because that other person that's working that's not the primary caregiver is earning a wage and they're putting...
So you're taking as they're splitting it three ways from their own earnings, then they're splitting it three ways. That's what this means. Great. I've had to literally learn this on as we're going. I was seeing them collectively putting their wages together, then splitting it out three ways.
So that's what I think you should be doing.
Yes, but you think they're personally both splitting out?
Yeah. So what would happen is if I'm on parental leave getting minimum pay by the government, which is like what, $800 now or something, depending on your tax brackets. So let's just say you get $800, then I'm splitting that three ways. So like my mortgage, another account, I'm getting like $200 to myself and most likely for my kids, it's not viable.
100%. It should be combined and then split out however you want to do it and then take into account. Are you going to a postpartum physio? Because I'm sorry, that should not be coming out of your personal account. Like that, you gave birth to your shared child and you're trying to get back your pelvic health. Like those sorts of things absolutely should be accounted for. So I absolutely agree with you. I was taking this as they were coming together first, then splitting the money out. And I was thinking, so they're ending up with even money. But even on top of that, even if someone does that, I think we then need to factor in that primary caregiver is spending more. So how much more extra do they need just to look after your child, but also to recover from pregnancy and birth? So I think that's two-pronged, isn't it?
Yeah. And the conversation is probably around like, what are no-go expenses? Like I understand this person might want to spend money on a face cream and their partner might want to spend money on video games, but perhaps if it's joint, you have the conversation, how much are you spending on that? Is it essential? Do we take the view that each week we have this play money and there is to be no argument, no conversation about it. What we do with it is at our own choice. But if you don't have that conversation before, like this is why split accounts work so well, right? Because I'm like, I'm going to get a massage. And Ryan would be like, that's such a waste of money. But for me, it's not. And then he buys a golf club. I'm like, what the fuck? What's going on there? And he's like, oh, it's essential. But when it's joint, you actually have to force yourself to have the conversations like, okay, we need to make a pact for the next 12 months or however long you're taking and say, this is our play money. And I am going to take a step back from placing judgment on what you do with it. But I, in the same like regards, I need you to do the same thing.
For people that have separate accounts and want to stick to that model, is there a case to be made for having a fourth account that really focuses on those days when you're at home with the kids and then also things like pelvic health and that sort of stuff? Like, could that be another option for people that really want to spread it out?
I think it should be, but it depends how progressive your relationship is.
Yeah. We're definitely more, we've just got a pool of money and we just basically tell each other when we're about to spend money and make sure that the other one's okay with it because that's just the way we go about it. But it becomes interesting when you're splitting it up into your sort of, say, fun me funds, And you're spending it all on pelvic health and they're spending it on video games. That just doesn't make sense to me. And you're spending yours also on baby chinos. That's just a no-y for me.
Exactly. But that's why you need to have the conversation. So like, what is the me money? What does that look like?
That's even a bigger conversation than even whether you split it or not. Like almost doesn't matter as long as you've had the conversation of these are the rules about how we can spend, acknowledging that maybe you can't spend money the way you could before because you now have a child. One of you might be earning less and also they cost more because they now exist in the world.
Yeah, but I will say, and I found this very fascinating, most people in Australia, like the statistics show, do not have a joint account.
Really? We only joined when Ray was born, I think. I do still have a separate account and I do keep some little funds in there every now and then to do what I want with, but it's not a strict, hard and fast rule.
So the banks will tell you from their data that most couples, most married couples do not have a joint account. They both have their own funds and they contribute if they have a mortgage to an offset, so they'll transfer. But I think this is why, I mean, this is a completely different topic and discussion, but this is why there is so much advocacy at the moment around financial abuse.
Yes.
Because when you don't have visibility or when you're in a really toxic relationship, that division of funds can be horrific.
Yeah. So we only joined when I was on mat leave because all of a sudden Hayden's funds meant something to me. Before that, it was we both have these full-time salaries. This is the cost of our mortgage. Everything else is in our personal accounts. So it's really interesting because financial abuse really can come from either angle. If you have the joint account and you have someone that is financially abusive, that might be a way that they can exercise control. But if you both have separate accounts, that sort of control exercise can come in a different way, can't it? It's like fraud either way. But the main thing is that you need to talk about the way you're spending your money.
Yeah. And you need to also be aware that, yes, you are getting paid, but you're not getting paid the same as what you were before. You're getting paid a lot less. You're also getting no superannuation in most cases. You're having to fork out a lot more money on your children because the likelihood is you're looking after them all day. And unless you're sitting at home playing DIY craft with flour and sugar and water, you're going to be spending some dollars. And those dollars add up. And if you don't talk about it, they come out of your personal account and you build resentment and you're like, this week I have spent $65 facilitating my children's happiness and I'm miserable.
Yeah. And you've spent none on it. You've just bought a lunch when you were out at work or whatever. I'm with you. It's not even necessarily that I think everything should be joined, but if that person's income has not changed because they're not the primary carer, and this person's has drastically changed, it is incredibly unfair to me. That then affects, they're basically, it's the motherhood penalty, right? It's already affecting every part of their lives. Your partner is earning the money outside of the home and you as a person that is working inside of the home should be fairly compensated.
Agreed. Couldn't agree more. I would advocate for that every day of the week.
Amen, sister. Let's go to the next one, Lozzie. This person says, Dear Lou and Loz, it feels very normal to shorten your names to nicknames, even though we've never met. And I just want to say, we would be shortening your nickname if we could meet you. But somehow listening to Ready or Not each week feels like I know you both already. That is a beautiful thing. I'm in a bit of a conundrum and I'm reaching out for advice or any kind of reference to a previous podcast on this subject I may have missed. My partner and I have been on our fertility journey for over 12 months, spending thousands on doctors, fertility specialists, naturopaths, acupuncturists, and supplements. In June, I was told by a fertility doctor that I have a low egg count and I may have PCOS just before my 36th birthday. I was in a fairly toxic work environment. I've been working in the same industry for close to 20 years. And for the past 7 or 8 years, I tried to pivot into a different department because I knew I could do it remotely or hybridly and I'd be doing less overtime / time in lieu. I've consistently been pigeonholed back into my original department and expertise. Even when I've taken hybrid roles, my previous role always triumphs. I'd finally had enough and quit my job. I wasn't getting pregnant. I was mega stressed commuting as we bought a house outside of the city because we couldn't afford a house in the city where we wanted to live. I could feel a burnout coming, and having previously worked in a really taxing industry for long hours, I knew what was around the corner. I have taken a substantial pay cut of $15,000 to land what feels like a great role at another workplace, one that feels like they will be able to offer genuine flexibility, work-life balance, career progression, and way less time-consuming parts of the job. The catch, I found out that I'm pregnant. My trimester 1 symptoms seem to be getting worse by the day, and I have no idea how I am going to face starting a new job, pretending to be my bright, sparkly self until it is safe enough to tell them I'm pregnant. This is my first pregnancy, and we have waited so long for this to happen, but I'm very afraid of what this means for my new role. They don't even know me yet, so I have no idea how I'm going to break the news. Any advice or references to similar stories would be so appreciated.
I have had a few team members in a similar situation, two that I can recall in particular, one who had a really positive outcome and one who still had a positive outcome but didn't necessarily get the mat leave that they were after. So that's something to consider. But I'll tell you the really positive one first. A person in my team started work, similar situation to you. I'm not sure of what her previous trying phase was, but she was pregnant. She was really, really sick. She had HG, so she couldn't really not say that she was pregnant. She took a couple of sick days and then it all came out. Everyone was really supportive. I mean, our team at the time was very female dominated, so there was never a question of anything other than wanting to make sure that she had a good experience and making sure she felt really supported. This person at the time was on the cusp of a mat leave change policy internally. So her and her direct manager really drove that, and she ended up getting mat leave and the ability to return back to her work within the position. She was there for roughly 7 months, I want to say, or 8 months, I think. Did she have to take a lot of unpaid leave? Yes. Was there additional flexibility from her working from home? Yes, because it was an almost fully remote company. So from that perspective, my opinion is if you're at a progressive workplace and you have a great manager, you can confide in that person and say, this is my story. This is where I'm coming from. I feel sick, like physically and literally, about having to tell you, but I'm so deeply excited and so deeply worried at the same time. And if you've got a great manager, that person is going to make you feel at ease and say, okay, these are the policies in place. This is what we can do to support you. We've got you back. Don't worry, blah, blah, blah. Personally, I would say if you can wait until your probation is finished, say then. Most companies now, they have a 6-month probation, but it used to be 3 months, but they just seem to be increasing, increasing, increasing.
Oh God, which does not work for pregnant people, does it?
I know. Likelihood is you're probably not going to be able to hold out for that long, but maybe hold out until you can for that safe zone, so around that 3-month mark, and have the conversation. Like, there's nothing else you can do. Like, a baby isn't something that kind of goes away. It's going to be there. I would also say this should be a time in your life when you are thrilled and overjoyed, and a new workplace shouldn't be taking or dimming that light from you. Like, you should be saying to your partner, fuck, we did it. How great. Like, it's a blessing. It can be so difficult to get pregnant. This is the start of what's going to be an incredible, hopefully, journey for you. Don't let the fear of telling your manager ruin that. I would proceed with caution. Do your research. I mean, I don't know about you, Lou, but I follow the Melbourne Mums group, and there's a lot of anonymous things that go in there with some great.
You're kidding. Well, you know, I'm locked out of Facebook, so I can't see.
Oh,
that
you
stuff.
Can't. Post a question in a big Facebook group and say, what have other people experienced? What have you done?
Like, yeah. We also had an episode like this, Lozzie, and I've actually written to that person to say, to ask if she can send us a voice memo of how it went. So I don't know if you remember, but she was early pregnant after some miscarriages. And you gave her advice on an earlier episode. So not only will I link that in the show notes and the advice that you gave then, but I've also asked her, and she's going to get back to us later today, with a voice memo of how it went, because it was a positive story and her experience with it all.
Hi, Lou and Loz. I thought I'd report back on my little parental leave conundrum for a fellow listener. I fell pregnant quite unexpectedly, and I had just shortly started a new role, a new job, and I was quite worried that I wouldn't get any paid parental leave, which I'm obviously very fortunate to even have access to for financial reasons, really. So it was quite scary. I received some really sage advice from the both of you because I wrote in and asked your advice. And the main takeaway that I took was honesty. Don't feel pressured that I needed to tell them ASAP, but primarily know my worth to the business. So the process that I went through was I didn't feel like I needed to tell them straight away, you know, at the 13-week mark. I tried to hold off as long as I could, because I wanted to try as much as possible to have served that 6 months probation period so that there was no chance of me losing my job, which, to be honest, in this workplace was never a possibility anyway. It's a great workplace. So I told them when I was about 17 weeks pregnant, I really only felt like I needed to because I had obviously started to show second child things. In that process, I went to my GM first. I then went to GM of PNC and then followed by our CEO. I had very open and honest conversations with each of them. And I was really grateful that they didn't sort of jump the gun. They just let me be happy. They were elated for me being pregnant. And they didn't start any conversations about parental leave or what the next steps would look like from a work perspective. So I was really grateful that that's the approach that they took. Then after these initial conversations, I went away and really started to think about what my worth was for this business. I have quite a unique skill set, so I was prepared to go into these next conversations and really pitch for myself. Fortunately, I didn't need to. In the next conversation that I had with the GM of PNC, I found out that they were going to give me the full 16 weeks of paid parental leave, even though I hadn't served the 12-month minimum period according to our parental leave policy, and that they would obviously hold my job for when I wanted to return. So I'm really fortunate that that was the way it eventuated. I think the main reason for that is because in the period of time I had been there, I had really showed them that, A, I was a bloody hard worker, but I really did show them my worth, and I didn't need to necessarily pitch that in the conversation, but I was really prepared to do that. So I hope this gives a fellow listener some confidence that it is most definitely possible to hold your job, even though you may not have served the minimum probation, to also potentially get some level of paid parental leave, even though you might not have served the minimum period of time according to the policy, which in many actual workplaces that there is no minimum term anymore, which I think is a really positive thing. So it is most definitely possible. I'm here to show that it definitely does happen. And just have confidence in yourself, confidence in what you do, and really know your worth and what you can bring to the business. That's really unique. And hopefully that shows them that you're here to stick around for the long term and that you're worth it.
One other thing I would say to put your mind at ease, because I know when this happens, sometimes your mind can run wild and you're like, I'm going to get fired. They're going to get rid of me. It is very difficult and very non-PC for a workplace to fire you or make you redundant or not let you serve out your probation once you tell them you're pregnant.
Yeah, most people aren't going to do it. However, there's so many loopholes. So that's why you say wait for as long as you can.
Wait for as long as you can, but most people aren't going to do it.
Yeah.
The only downside, I would say, from like a pay perspective of you being newly pregnant, starting a new job, is that you may not be able to access the maternity leave. But in the scheme of things, whatever mat leave policy they have, maybe it's 14 weeks. I know it seems like a lot at the time. In the longevity of life, those 14 weeks aren't going to be a make or break. I'm sure you've already spent thousands of dollars on IVF treatment, and this is like a blessing in disguise. So maybe just frame it in that way.
And big congratulations. We really hope everything goes well. And I'm sorry that you're feeling
so
unwell. That sucks.
It absolutely will. And if it doesn't, that workplace is not for you. And we/I will always help you find a role.
Yeah. Come to us. Absolutely.
I live
come
for
to
it.
Us. You do. You could be an HR recruiter. An HR recruiter, is that even a phrase? What am I talking about?
I've never done recruitment, but I love it.
Last one here, Lozzie, is from another very loyal listener who we adore. This person says, there was a department restructure at my work late last year. I was 4 months into mat leave with my second child at the time. And as a result, a number of roles were made redundant, including mine. I know it was a business decision and not reflective of my skills. If anything, I had personally achieved the best results in the lead up to mat leave. But now that I want to return to work and am in the thick of job hunting, I'm freaking out. How do I explain to recruiters or HR managers the combo of redundancy and mat leave? And how do I best reflect this on my resume and LinkedIn? Worried about the unconscious bias, if I'm being honest. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk, this person ends with.
This has happened. This is the whole reason why we started Witching Hour. Like, yeah. I'm not even joking. I have genuinely been in your position.
Yeah.
So Zabe was 4 months and I got made redundant on mat leave. And at the time, I was kind of thrilled, to be honest. But in the back of my mind, I thought, shit, I wanted to go back part-time. I didn't know what I was going to do. I was like, I'm never going to be able to get a job that's not a receptionist. I've worked too hard to do that. There's nothing wrong with being a receptionist. But for me, I was like, fucking hell. Like, I've worked my bloody ring hole off to get to where I'm at. And I don't want to take a step back. I wanted to be on the path that I was on. So, a couple of things. Know that 1,000 people have been in your position and it is becoming far more common. So you're not alone. Secondly, you do not have to put it on your resume. Why do you have to put it on your resume? For what purpose?
Yeah, you could just be looking for a new job. Yeah.
Exactly. When you speak to a recruiter, be honest. Say, I was made redundant on mat leave. This is the things that I'm looking for. I'm looking for a workplace that has A, B, C, D with the role that looks like X, Y, Z. Do not stop yourself from applying for full-time roles. I think that's the biggest learning. I've had a girlfriend recently who went through a similar situation. And the first thing I said to her was, obviously, how are you feeling? But then the second thing I said was, do not apply for full-time roles. Because if you're looking for part-time roles, they are few and far between. Often they are lower pay. And if you are the preferred candidate, ask the question, can I do a 9-day fortnight? Can I start with 3 days and work up to 5? Can I trial 4 days? If they like you and they have invested in you, one thing that I will say is talent is so hard. Good talent and the right cultural fit is really, really difficult to find. And once you are through to that like almost final round of interviews, you hold the cards. It might not feel like it, but you do.
I want to add two things. One is that lately I've been feeling really guilty with my return to paid work, that motherhood has gotten in the way so much. And I've been feeling like, why would they want to work with me? I am so unreliable. My kids are getting in the way, blah, 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 blah. First one on that is that people have different distractions in their lives. I think when we become mums, we just get this stupid guilt and we feel like that the only blockage of a career is motherhood and that something's innately wrong within us. So firstly, remember that people have all sorts of things that they're juggling in life. Just because you've become a mum, that doesn't mean that you're immediately like this other that isn't a good worker. Secondly on that is that people get laid off and made redundant in so many different ways and they post about it loudly on LinkedIn. So if you're someone that actually would rather talk about it, so you can either take that route of not talking about it and that's great because you shouldn't need to. You went on mat leave, now you're looking for a new role. Fab, go you.
Also, don't forget, you're still on mat leave.
Yeah, exactly. Look, but I think secondly,
you're on mat leave. You've got 12
months. If you are the person that wants to talk about it, don't forget that there's all these dads and men out there that have had layoffs from different tech companies or different news sites that are talking really loudly and proudly about being made redundant on LinkedIn. So if that is more you, use it as your superpower to open up a conversation and talk about how it's made you feel, that it's made you feel like maybe you're lacking in this area, but actually you know that that's not true because you achieved X, Y, and Z at work. So whichever approach you go for, I think own it. Either don't talk about it and own that or talk about it and be really open and vulnerable.
Yeah, but just don't be afraid. Just don't limit yourself in this box of I only want to work 3 days, I only want to work in this industry, I only want to work for this pay. Because if you do that, if you add all of these filters on, your job search list is going to be tiny. Like take some of them off, get through the first hurdle of getting to the interview. Be your amazing self, wow them with your skills and your personality and your right cultural fit. And the rest is just a negotiation. Everything in life, everything is up for negotiation once you're through the door. And the door's the interview. Once you're through and you're allowed to ask, am I the preferred candidate? They're going to tell you yes or no. If they say yes, bargaining power is yours, my friend. There's no one else like you. Like literally.
Go for gold.
There's no one. Ask the question. Say, I'd really like to trial 4 days and let's review it in 3 months' time. And if it doesn't work, I can go to 5. Guarantee you, if you check in on a weekly basis, how am I performing? How am I going? Are you happy with my output? At the end of that 3 months, you're going to get what you want. You just need to make sure that there's parameters in place that are going to work to your benefit. But if you're the best performer and you made redundant, honestly, I mean, yeah, it's a slog crafting your resume. And we've done a tips and tricks episode on this with great hacks. Definitely listen to it. But network, put yourself out there. I feel like you'll probably find something better.
That is an inspiring call to action way to end this show, Lozzie. You really put a fire up my bottom. And I can hear Posey crying, which is unfortunate because this isn't the 2-hour day sleep that I was hoping for her midday nap. So unfortunately, we need to wrap up. Lead us out, my friend.
If you have loved listening to today's Witching Hour, please leave us a positive review. Every review helps. We love to see them, even if it's constructive criticism. And follow us on RadioNot.com. Catch you next week.